estate sales transactions in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. RE/MAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting.
Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dale, Henry Frain is at the controls. Once again this morning in the second part of the show, we will go to the Focus 580 archives, another biography for you. This, The Life of William Jennings Bryan, a program first broadcast on June 28th. And in this hour, once again, we will not be taking your calls. In this hour of our program, we'll be talking about the life of William Jennings Bryan. He is someone who today, I think, will be chiefly remembered for his role in the Scopes Trial of 1925 as an opponent of the teaching of evolution and as a fundamentalist Christian. However, our guest for this part of Focus, historian Michael Kazin, says that there is much, much more to William Jennings Bryan than that. He is a very interesting, complicated, multifaceted character. And what he wants to do, that is what Mr. Kazin wants to do, is restore Bryan to his proper place in the history of progressive politics in this country as someone who had a lot to do with shaping the identity of the Democratic Party as we think of it today, or at least as we thought of it in the eras of the New Deal and of the Great Society. Michael Kazin, our guest, teaches history at Georgetown University, and he's the author of a newly published biography of Bryan, which is titled A Godly Hero, and it's published by Knopf. Our guest is the author of three previous books about American history, America Divided, The Populist Persuasion, and Barons of Labor. He's frequent contributed to New York Times, Washington Post, The Nation, and The American Prospect, among other publications. Professor Kazin, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Before taking a look at the book and trying to learn a little bit about Mr. Bryan, I don't know that I could have told you very much about him other than the Scopes trial, the monkey trial. That and I suppose maybe what I would know about that and probably what a lot of people would know wouldn't really come from a reading of history. It would come from Inherit the Wind. I was very interested to learn just how complicated a man he was and about the fact that he really led the charge on so many big issues in progressive politics. He believed in a progressive income tax. He believed that workers should have the right to strike. He believed that women should have the right to vote. He believed in the power of government to balance the power of big business. All of those really bedrock kind of progressive ideas.
Yes, and that's the reason he was nominated three times by the Democrats, not because of evolution. That issue really didn't become important until World War I, 1920s, which was more than 10 years after he stopped running for president.
The other thing that I guess strikes me about him, particularly when you think about the range of his beliefs, all of those things, and also set aside that, the fact that he was a very religious man. He believed strongly in Christian values. He believed in temperance. He believed that prohibition was a good thing. He did have this strong attitude as far as evolution goes. Is that if you look at the range of his beliefs, you would have to think that in today's political environment, that someone like William Jennings Bryan would be impossible.
That's possible. I mean, there are people who try to be sort of evangelical leftists, if you will, or at least liberals. People like Jim Wallace, for example, and there's several others. Tony Campolo, less well known than Jim Wallace. There's others out there. But certainly his moral politics, if you will, seems to go one way, and his economic and social politics seems to go the other way. But for Bryan, 100 years ago or so, it was no contradiction. He believed that every true Christian was an anti-monopolist. Every true Christian believed in favoring human beings over mammon. Every good Christian, in his mind, believed in, trying to put the Sermon on the Mount into policy, so to speak. And he thought he was representing the meek who should inherit the earth. So in his mind, there was no contradiction. Even though now, of course, we tend to think of serious Christians as being conservative politically. But that's a fairly new development, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think it is here. This, you know, this is the fundamental thing and on which all of these values rest, or from where they come. So I guess you really cannot get away from his religious faith. But it is perhaps surprising, though, the way he reads the scriptures and what that says about how people ought to be in the world, that seems to mark him for his time, and also marks him for ours, in a sense that there is this split between his, let's say, economic progressivism and his cultural conservatism.
Yes, and also one thing that's important to realize, 100 years ago, no one doubted that this was a Protestant nation and that Protestants were dominant, both in politics and in religious life. And there wasn't really much of a challenge to that in a serious way. And so a lot of the debates that Brian took part in were debates among Protestants about what their politics should be and how they should read the Bible and how they should apply what they read in Scripture. So in that sense, that's quite different from the much more pluralist and, I think, tolerant religious atmosphere we have now.
Yeah. One thing that I think we want to talk about here is his origins, and I feel incumbent upon me to say, although that Nebraskans claim him, and he lived in Nebraska and campaigned in Nebraska, he was born in the state of Illinois.
Yeah, in Salem, in Marion County. And he went to school in Jacksonville, both high school and college, Illinois College, which is still there. And he thought about making his political career in Illinois, actually, but the district that he would have represented in Jacksonville was already controlled pretty solidly by Republicans. He thought there wasn't much chance there. Democratic Party was, you know, sort of knew who they wanted to run for office for the next few years, even if they weren't going to be successful. So that's one of the reasons why he moved to Nebraska. Nebraska was sort of the new frontier in many ways. It was growing quite rapidly at the time.
Mm. His father was involved in Democratic politics?
Yeah, his father was a state senator from Southern Illinois. He was involved in the Constitutional Convention that rewrote the Constitution of Illinois after the Civil War. And his father ran for Congress as well and was not elected. he was an important judge as well in Marion County.
So how is it that, and so we could see he comes by his association with the Democratic Party naturally, how is it that religious faith and religious values become so much a part and really a, sort of the defining thing of his life?
Well, his father was very devout. His father was, even when he was hearing a case in court, he would pray three times a day. He would adjourn court in order to pray. And his father also really didn't think there was any contradiction between a devout Christian and being a fairly progressive Democrat for the time. And again, his father grew up at the time of the Second Great Awakening, which some of your historically informed listeners might know, was a time of tremendous sort of evangelical enthusiasm. There's also a time when Andrew Jackson gets elected and when most of the barriers against voting for white men are thrown down. And so his father was sort of part of that evangelical small D Democratic and large D Democratic wave at the time. And Brian, like a lot of people, just imbibed that from his father, from his mother as well. His mother was involved in the temperance movement, the WCTU, the leading organization of women in the temperance movement at the time. So in that sense, he really didn't fall that far from the tree. but of course, he applied those beliefs in somewhat different ways than his parents had.
Mm. As you explained, he had this interest perhaps in getting involved in politics, but that the Republicans were too strong where he grew up, and so he moved to Nebraska and was indeed elected to Congress as a Democrat two times. What was there always from the time that now I know that he did indeed go to college, he studied classics, he graduated from law school in Chicago.
Right.
Was there always, though, this interest in Brian in running for office, in being involved in electoral politics?
His father ran for office. His father had not been elected. And even though his father didn't live to see Brian elected to Congress, Brian always wanted to sort of right that wrong, so to speak, I think. And He always loved politics. He always loved speaking too. There's a reminiscence from a family doctor that he was giving speeches on the at age four from the porch of his little home in Salem. And no one knows what he was actually talking about, but that was, you know, being a great orator and being a great politician seemed to go together. In fact, you really couldn't be a serious political figure unless you were a pretty good speaker at the time. Well, if you wanted to get elected time and again, because that's how you campaign, of course, without the mass media around.
Right. Well, by all accounts, he was a great speaker, was much in demand, actually made a living by doing that, because at the time there were opportunities for doing public speaking, and for a lot of people that was a great form of entertainment to go down and hear someone talk. And apparently he was an indefatigable speaker. He was practically almost inexhaustible. He spoke particularly when he was, I guess, running for office, but maybe even after that, because he was almost always running for a period of time. It sounds like he spoke hours and hours every day, give any speeches, some long ones, some shorter ones. He seemed almost that he must have been almost inexhaustible.
Yeah, he was blessed with an amazing voice. You know, it's too bad the starting pitchers for the Cubs don't have such good arms as he had a voice. Maybe they'd be doing better these days. You know, he was able to – he spoke during the 1896 campaign. When he was a young man, he was only 36 at the time. He spoke perhaps 10 hours a day, sometimes long speeches, sometimes short ones. He didn't have microphones yet. Their amplified sound really didn't begin to be used in a major way until the 1920s. So this was all just the power of his own voice. And he could speak to 10,000 people without amplification in the open, and, of course, even more inside a hall where the acoustics were better. And he wrote all his own speeches and sometimes read them from a text. Sometimes some speeches he'd given so many times, he was just memorized them, and so he didn't need notes. He was like a fine actor who keeps, you know, doing, who can do lots of different plays, but there's certain plays, say Shakespearean plays, that he just knows his parts by heart, and people like to hear him. Even if they've already heard him once, they like to hear him again. And so he was. He became fairly wealthy, really, as a speaker, whether or not he was running for office.
Well, it seems that, you know, now one of the facts of public life for politicians is that, at least for some, is that the line between being a celebrity and being a public servant blurs a little bit. It seems that he may have been one of the first, or perhaps the first, to combine those two, to be a politician and to be a celebrity, both.
Yes, I think so. In fact, I originally was going to subtitle the book something like The Rise of Celebrity Politics, and I decided not to because I thought that might diminish the his significance politically. But he was the first major party politician, really, to build his own personal machine in election time and at election time. He had his own newspaper, which was pretty popular, called The Commoner. It came out every week for a while and then every month, and had a pretty large circulation for the time. And he had a card file of people who had written to him. He wrote back to most of them. And so just as now we think of people running for president really having to build a sort of medium-sized business around themselves with pollsters and advertising people and to raise money for themselves, and then the party latches on to them, Bryan was one of the first to really do that. The party sometimes helped him, sometimes didn't, but he only needed the party for the line on the ballot. He didn't really need them to push for him. He did a lot of that himself.
He apparently was also really the first one to campaign in a sense the way candidates do now, by traveling widely, traveling across the country, making a lot of stops, and essentially having a standard set of speeches that he would deliver.
Yes, and you know, the old tradition in the 19th century up until Bryan, in most elections, was that the office was supposed to seek the man, not the other way around. The example of George Washington, who sort of only reluctantly agreed to run for president, never would have thought of giving a speech for himself. That was the model. And you had a lot of party speakers who spoke for the candidate, but the candidate didn't speak for himself. But in 1896, Bryan both loved to speak and was very good at it, as we were discussing, but also he had no choice because the Republicans outspent him by 10 to 1 in that election. the Democrats in that election, 1896, spent a grand total of $250,000. And so basically Bryan, with railroad tickets in hand, was the campaign.
It seems that it might be a kind of a big leap from a two-term congressman from Lincoln, Nebraska, to the Democratic presidential nominee, but he indeed became really a national figure in 1896 when he ran for president. How did he indeed make that link, that leap from Nebraska congressman to the Democratic presidential candidate?
Well, there was a revolt in the country in the 1890s. There was a Great Depression in the 90s. It was called the Great Depression at the time, almost as bad as the Great Depression in the 30s. And the Democratic Party was splitting wide open. The incumbent president, Grover Cleveland, was a pretty conservative guy. He did not support giving jobs to the unemployed. He did not support really the government doing much at all for people who were out of work. And there was also a revolt on the farms. The Populist Party had run its own candidate in 1892, and they seemed to be gaining strength as well. So Bryan managed to go around the country speaking, identifying himself with those insurgencies, identifying himself with rebels within his own party who wanted to change policy and really have the government take more responsibility for helping people who were in trouble, especially small farmers and workers. And so he was something of a dark horse candidate when he got to the convention, which took place in Chicago in July 1896. But he was known around the country as a great speaker about issues of concern to the rebels in the party. And then he gave this great speech, the so-called Cross of Gold speech, during the debate about the currency issue in the platform. And that made him the odds-on favorite to win the nomination, which he did the next day.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for this hour of the program. We're talking with Michael Kazin. He's professor of history at Georgetown University, and he's the author of a recent biography of William Jennings Bryan. The title of his book is A Godly Hero, and it is published by Knopf, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is the Cross of Gold speech is probably his most famous speech, that he delivered at the Democratic Convention in 1896, and probably aside from the Scopes trial, it may be the other thing that people will know him for. At the same time, I think that for a lot of people today, myself included, this argument about bimetallism is arcane, to say the least, and I think that probably a lot of people won't really understand what this debate over the gold standard and whether we stayed with gold as the basis for the currency, or whether, as Bryan and a lot of people argued, there should be silver coinage, there should be both. I think that now a lot of people have difficulty understanding what this was really about.
Well, I'll make it as simple as I can, as a good history teacher should. First of all, all the money in the country then could be redeemed by a precious metal, an amount of precious metal that was in the Federal Treasury. So that's part of it, is that people talked about whether the currency should be based on gold or silver, because it really was based on gold and silver. You could take a paper dollar to the Treasury and redeem it. But in a larger sense, the debate was really between the haves and the have-nots. Gold was the currency of creditors. It was currency because it was fairly rare. It kept the prices down, but also kept interest rates high. The Bank of England and the British Empire in general was in favor of gold. British financiers were very important in the American economy at the time. On the other hand, silver was more plentiful, especially in the United States, and if the currency was going to be based on gold and silver, then you could have inflated the money supply, and that would have helped people get out of debt. And a lot of people were in debt in the 1890s, losing their farms, losing their homes, and that was quite appealing to them. Also, as often happens, the issue was really about who you don't like as much as what you want. And if you didn't like the British Empire, if you didn't like the Bank of England, if you didn't like the big financiers in the East Coast cities, often you tended to side with Bryan, and people wanted to coin silver as well as gold.
Yeah. I guess what's also interesting to me is that it seems that this is an issue that it says something about who was supporting Bryan, because it crossed party lines. That is, it wasn't clearly a Republican-Democrat issue. There were Democrats who favored staying with gold.
Yes.
There were free silver Republicans. So it seemed to be that it also says something about how the fact that Brian did indeed have received support from Republican populists. So it wasn't the lines dividing people were maybe not quite as hard and clear cut as they are.
Yeah, it was more based on region than based on party, per se. That's quite true. The Northeast tended to be very pro-gold and pro-Republican, especially in 1896, whereas the rest of the country, for the most part, was more sided more with Bryan. But the Northeast quadrant, where most of the industry was and more of the banking interests were, had a lot of people, and so more electoral votes.
Well, we have a caller here, a couple of them, to bring into the conversation. So why don't we do that? We'll start with someone here in Champaign County, where we are, line number one.
Hi there.
Hi.
I had a reminiscence talking to my grandfather, who must have seen Bryan gallivanting around Illinois at 1896. But while you're on gold and silver, an obscure fact from a history book about U.S. Central American and Latin American relations was that when the Panama Canal was being built, whites were paid in gold and all others were paid in silver. So it seems like there is some kind of other dimension, cultural or otherwise, describe that. But my reminiscence is, I wish I could remember more. I wish I'd have taken notes. I was fairly young when I talked to my grandfather, who was like a charter member to the Progressive magazine out of Madison, so he was like plugged into the farm labor coalitions of that time. And the only thing I can really remember when he was barnstorming was that Jennings had this elaborate coach with six white horses, and they were just very impressive, I guess. Though I had a feeling that my grandfather didn't in some way thought it was a little too flamboyant. He was from a German, mainly German Catholic, some Lutheran settlement area down in St. Clair County and Washington County area. So I think that's where he saw him. But I don't know how you can react to that. I was wondering about the, since religiosity was so important, I wonder whether part of his, I mean, he was certainly for the progressive politics of the time, but the other cultural things were probably important to him as well. I don't know if you can give us any insight into that dynamic or not. And I guess I'm going to go back to what I was doing here and listen off the air. Thank
you. All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thanks. That's a good point about the Panama Canal workers. In fact, skilled white workers were known as gold workers, and the menial workers, who usually were not white, sometimes black, sometimes Latin, sometimes Indians, were called silver workers. So, even the hierarchy certainly was very important, and the cultural meaning of the issue was vital, certainly. On the issue of your grandfather and his religious background, there was an important split between evangelical Protestants like Bryan and both Lutherans and Catholics, I think, who are very numerous, of course, about the issue of whether the government should legislate morality, as we put it today. And prohibition was the key issue there. Lutherans and Catholics tended to be quite opposed to any idea of prohibition. They thought, beer is part of life, beer gardens, of course, were brought over from Germany and from Bohemia, which is now Czech Republic, and they just thought it was absurd to tell people that it was a evil thing to sell alcohol. And that's something which did divide evangelical Protestants like Bryan. Though Bryan was a smart politician, he never supported prohibition until he stopped running for office, because he knew it would split the Democrats wide open, because lots of Lutherans and Catholics were Democrats.
One of the things that now we debate and talk a lot about is the place of religion in public life. And, to the extent to which we think it's appropriate for candidates to talk about their religious values and to say right up front that their religious values influence the way they think about making policy and what is the appropriate role of government in people's lives and so forth. And certainly for him, his religious values informed, sounds like they informed everything that he did. But that really wasn't, for the time, that really wasn't all that unusual. Now, it might for him have been stronger than it would have been for others, but certainly in those times there was no shortage of religious imagery and religious language being used and employed by politicians.
Oh, no. In fact, every president from Rutherford B. Hayes, famous Rutherford B. Hayes, 1876, all the way really up through Wilson, who didn't leave office till 1921, was a church-going Christian, and only really Teddy Roosevelt, William Howard Taft were not particularly devout. The rest of them were. William McKinley had thought about being a minister and taught Sunday school as a Methodist, and Woodrow Wilson was the son of a Presbyterian minister and was much sterner, I think, about his religiosity than Bryan himself was. I think, you know, the King James Bible was the one book that almost every American had in their homes. And so citing it, quoting from it, using metaphors from it, applying it to public life in various ways, that was just expected. In fact, it would have been strange if a politician decided not to do that. At the same time, it could be applied in all different ways. And one of the things about Bryan, which is interesting, I think, we think of, well, he must have been concerned about divorce and homosexuality and abortion, issues like that. But those were not issues at the time. His application of his faith was really mostly about matters of economic policy, social policy. It wasn't about the kinds of issues of sexuality that and personal life that we think about now.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. This is someone in a not too far away community, Belgium, near Danville, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir. Mm-hmm. I did miss a bit of your program, but I was wondering if you could speak about Bryant and his relationship to the Chautauqua that used to travel the eastern United States quite a bit. If I remember right, he was a very large speaker at these things on a very regular basis.
Oh, yeah. That's how he made a lot of his money.
Yeah.
Really beginning in about 1902, 1903, he began every summer to travel the circuit, tent circuit as it was called, sometimes speaking in halls, sometimes speaking in tents. And he was the most popular speaker that the tent circuit ever had. One of the bookers for the circuit said that he was good for 20 acres of Fords any day or any night. And he made top dollar. He made $250 per talk and extra if he got more than the expected number of people to come. And that was, you know, good money at the time, $2,000 or $3,000 per talk in our dollars today. And he spoke about both political and religious topics.
He used this as a sounding board for his elections and stuff like this, didn't he?
Yeah, although he tended to keep them separate. He wanted to please the crowds. He wanted to please the promoters as well. And so he did not spend his time sort of saying, you should vote for Democrats or you should vote for Republicans. Though, of course, he could do that in a more subtle way by emphasizing certain issues. But he was a headliner, really, on that circuit. And he managed to do something which was, you know, still rare at the time, was he was quite comfortable with other people in the circuit, sometimes who were vaudeville people, humorous, some people who was once in a while a little risque, though not usually. But he really made that circuit, and he passed around the same time that the circuit was rolling up, too, in the mid-1920s.
Thank you very much, sir.
Sure. Thank you for the call online. We'll continue. I'll talk next with someone in Danville. This is line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I, too, have a grandfather's story. My grandfather established a newspaper in Salem, Illinois in the 1880s called the Marion County Democrat.
I've read it.
And when William Jennings Bryan came back to Salem, because he still had a lot of relatives there, one of his aunts was my father's teacher in high school, and my father had seen him in the office several times. And interestingly enough, after my grandfather retired, sold the paper, and it was run by that name for a while, And there was another paper in town. These were just weekly papers in those days, in the 1880s, and that was the Salem Times Republican, I believe. And I noticed in his diary of 1886 that once in a while, when the press would break down, why, they'd help each other out by running their respective papers. And but then those two papers merged, I don't know how long ago, maybe 30. So the, now this paper in Salem is called the Salem Times Commoner.
Right.
And in reference, I thought my father had said something about a parade in which there were 16 white horses and one gold or one palomino horse. Was that the ratio?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they wanted to coin silver at the ratio of 16 to 1 to gold.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And I have one other reminiscence, I guess. That Cross of Gold speech he recorded in... in the studio,
mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, I suppose those records are still pretty widely held.
In fact, you can hear them online, historicalvoices.org. Not a bad rendition. Of course, he was.
Yeah, it was in a studio. It was Thomas Edison's studio, wasn't it?
Yeah. Gannett was the name of the company.
Yeah, well, I have that record. Well, actually, it was put out by the Democratic Party years and years ago, and that was the first one of the Democratic candidates. I had a couple of questions. Was he not also governor of Nebraska?
No. He was elected to the Congress twice, and he ran for Senate. He would have won if there had been a popular vote, but then the Senate was elected by the legislature, and the Republicans controlled the legislature.
And the other is, I'd like for you to speculate, it's my feeling.
Well, I should say his brother was elected governor of Nebraska.
Oh, who was also born in Salem.
Brother Charles, yes.
Okay, well, I knew that four governors had been born in this relatively small community, and one was Nebraska and one was Florida, and I don't know where the other two fellows were from. I'd like for you to conjecture for a moment. It's my feeling that Brian would not have been an environmentalist. What do you think?
Well, of course, you know, historians hate to think what would someone have done if they're 146 years old, which is what he'd be today. I don't know. You know, I think the way a lot of evangelicals now are talking about there's a need to be stewards of the earth, for example, and to preserve it for future generations. I don't know. I mean, he was active at a time when really the environmental movement was first getting going. It was called conservation then, as opposed to environmentalism. But he was supportive of the kind of things Teddy Roosevelt was doing, certainly. It wasn't a major issue for him. But so I don't know about that. I think he certainly never made any statements opposed to it. And as I said, he was supportive of the beginnings of that movement at the time.
Well, when you talk about him being a progressive, did he and, the fellow in Wisconsin, Phil and
La Follette.
La Follette. Were there connections with him?
Yeah, they were quite close in many ways. La Follette was trying to do in the Republican Party what Bryan had done in the Democratic Party, which is split off the progressives from the conservatives.
Right.
And La Follette, as you might know, wanted to run for president, tried very hard to win the nomination in 1912 and was not elected, and then thought maybe he'd run a third-party ticket, but Teddy Roosevelt beat him to that, too. So, no, there's a very warm correspondence, in fact, between Robert La Follette Sr. And Bryan. And in Bryan's magazine, he used to say very nice things about La Follette.
Well, I was a classmate through junior high and high school and college with Robert La Follette III, so I knew him quite well, but I had no idea that there was a connection with Brian and the Progressive Party in that aspect. So, well, thank you very
much.
Well,
thanks for the call. William Jennings Bryan ran for president three times,
yes.
1896, 1900, 1908. And I think that his most successful run was the first one.
Yes.
That run. One might wonder, even though he was an important figure in the Democratic Party, why it is that they ran him three times and certainly the third time since he was not successful the first two. Why did they stay with him as a candidate, or why did they hang with him as a candidate that long?
Well, he had this huge following. And nobody else in the party really did. So even though it looked like he was as much of a he was even more unpopular than he was popular, in the sense that the Republicans could mobilize against him. He was a polarizing figure because he was seen as a dangerous radical by a lot of Americans. Nevertheless, he had this group of loyalists, mostly from the West and the South, who really thought that he was the only honest man in politics, the only godly hero, as I titled the book. And so they thought, well, better to lose with Bryan than win with somebody who will not support the politics we support. So, of course, they thought before this is the before the days of polling. So they led themselves to believe that because he was getting such huge crowds, because there was so much enthusiasm behind him, that obviously he was going to win. And of course, they were wrong about that. The Republicans were better organized than the Democrats were. But at the time, if you have the kind of huge following he had, and you're able to stoke it and to build your own campaign apparatus, as he did, as I mentioned before, then you're going to have a leg up on other candidates. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't until he lost the third time that he said, okay, this is enough. But then he becomes a very important kingmaker during the 1912 convention and helps to get Wilson the nomination in 1912, and then becomes Secretary of State, part as a thank you from Wilson for helping him win. So, he was sort of the unavoidable figure in the party, so to speak.
He only served as Secretary of State for about 2 years.
2 years, yes.
And then left because he was unhappy with there was I'm sort of drawing a blank on what the reason was. He had a disagreement with the president. He was unhappy about policymaking, so he quit. What was it that led to his
issue? It was the issue of World War One, whether the U.S. should enter World War One or not. He thought after the. Again, historically informed listeners, and a lot of them seem to be, those who are calling up might know the very important flashpoint in U.S. Road to entering World War One took place in 1915 when a British passenger ship, a lot of Americans abroad, the Lusitania, was torpedoed by a German U-boat. And after this happened, after this happened, the President Wilson wanted to send some very angry notes to the Germans, blaming them for all that had happened. This, Bryan believed, would have jeopardized America's neutrality in the war. And he also thought that, as it turned out later to be right, that there were munitions aboard. And so in some ways, Lusitania was a warship masquerading as a passenger ship. So that's one of the reasons so many people died and it blew up so quickly. So he could not go along with Wilson. What he saw as Wilson's tilt against Germany in favor of Great Britain and France in the war. He thought the U.S. was going to get into the war. He didn't want to be a party to that. He wanted to oppose the war. He thought it was a disaster for the world and would have been a disaster for the United States to enter it. And so he resigned rather than be a party to that policy.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Michael Kazin. He's professor of history at Georgetown University. He is the author of a recently published biography of William Jennings Bryan. The title of his book is A Godly Hero. It's published by Knopf. It is in the bookstore now if you want to read it. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have someone calling from Kankakee. We'll talk with them next on our line four. Hello.
This caller would comment that it seems unlikely that the ruling junta of the United States is going to be displaced except by the emergence of a godly hero or the emergence of godly heroes. Contemporary opposition to the junta does not fit the bill. As you state in your book, the obvious problem for liberals is that most Americans don't share their mistrust of public piety. Would you please speculate on whether another godly hero, quote, preaching that it is the duty of a true Christian to transform a nation and a world plagued by the arrogance of wealth and pain of inequality, unquote, will emerge? Thank you.
You sound much like Bryan's people. So I salute you for that. I don't know about that. I think that we have a political environment now in which rightly or wrongly, people wearing their religion on their sleeve and basing their policy very publicly on it is mistrusted by a lot of people. I mistrust some of that myself. I'm not a Christian. I'm a Jew, and it's, you know, I'm part of a minority faith in the country, so I don't like to feel bullied by the majority faith. At the same time, I do think we're seeing more and more, and Republicans probably began this, an inclination on the part of politicians to base their moral statements in at least a general sense of religious faith. They don't necessarily quote the Bible specifically about it. They don't necessarily say one has to believe this if one wants to be a moral person. And I think that is happening on both sides, whether in the ruling junta or not. Of course, in many ways, we identify President Bush with that language more than most Democrats, with a few exceptions. So I don't expect a Brian to emerge again. You know, history does not repeat itself, and it's 100 years after his heyday. But I do think that the intersection between religious faith and politics is something which is integral to American political history, and it's not going away.
As we have said, Brian was a complex and multifaceted man, and we can talk about a lot of different things, and perhaps we can find reasons that we would admire him and things where we'd part ways. And one of the things I want to talk about is race, because he certainly could be faulted for not denouncing institutional racism in the South, blocks to African-Americans voting. At one point in when he was running, the last time when he was running, W.E.B. Du Bois offered to support him, and Brian turned him away, thinking that it would not be good for him to have the support of someone like that. Can you talk a little bit about that, about his attitudes, about race?
Well, one of the things that typified the Democratic Party of his day was that it was the Jim Crow Party. I mean, it was the party whose strongest battalions were in the White South. And the Republicans weren't much better by then, but certainly they still were seen as a party of Lincoln and a party that had, saved the Union and freed the slaves. So that was Brian's heritage, and that was his father was a Stephen Douglas Democrat, you know, the great senator from Illinois, who was someone who, as you probably know, opposed Lincoln and opposed abolition. Given that reality, given the fact that if you wanted to get the nomination in the Democratic Party and if you wanted to win an election, you had to win the White South, Brian, no matter what his political feelings, was going to be cowardly at best about that issue, despite the fact that some of his supporters, a few of his supporters were black, especially some from Nebraska, and pleaded with him to, you know, take a principled stand on this issue. I think as he got older, actually, he probably got more racist. He seemed to struggle with the issue in his youth to a certain degree. There's a poignant poem he wrote when he was Secretary of State, trying to come to grips with how God could in his righteousness, look kindly on the kind of exploitation and oppression that black people suffered. But by the 1920s, he was supporting white supremacy. He was aghast at some of the race riots that had taken place and during World War One. And so he was, unfortunately, a pretty typical white Democrat of his day. And, of course, it wasn't until the 1930s and 40s, really, the Democrats broke with that tradition.
As we talked about a little bit at the beginning, or certainly I mentioned at the beginning, I think that probably for a lot of people, if they know anything about him, what they think of is the Scopes trial of 1925. You have written about how that probably for a lot of people solidified his image and his identity in a lot of people's minds. And, of course, he died days after that. So that was right at the end of his life. How did he become involved in that?
Well, he had always believed as a devout Christian who, you know, believed that the Bible is true. He'd always, you know, thought, he never supported evolution, but he didn't really think it was an important issue until World War One. And then he was so aghast at the war that he was he began to read some literature which connected the German war machine with belief in Darwinism, and he also began to make links between social Darwinism, survival of the fittest and this kind of idea applied to society with the big money, with big industrialists, with eugenics, which was a movement that was becoming popular in the 20s. And so he threw all this into one big barrel, in a sense, but one big intellectual barrel, and began to believe, as a lot of evangelical Protestants did at the time, and some Catholics as well, that if young people were taught that they derive from beasts, that they would behave in brutish ways, there'd be no morality, there'd be no sense of the higher virtues. And so Brian believed that to save the children, so to speak, evolution had to be at least taught as a theory and not as fact, and at best kept out of the public schools altogether. But for him, again, it was in the context of the time, he saw it as a progressive move, because he thought that the main supporters of Darwinism in politics tended to be conservatives who thought it was fine, the competition was okay, the dog-eat-dog competition was fine in politics and in economic life. It was a short-sighted view and certainly an anti-scientific view, but nevertheless, it was consistent with his earlier beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that his involvement in that, and particularly the efforts of people like H.L. Mencken to style him as being sort of an ignorant backwoods boob, which he certainly was not, in a sense unfairly tarnished his reputation, and that still colors the way people see Brian?
Yes, I think so. And as you mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, Inherit the Wind is a very powerful play and movie, even though it was really based more on the scriptwriter's views about McCarthyism than it was about the actual debate between Clarence Darrow and Brian at the Scopes trial. I think certainly evangelicals, fundamentalist evangelicals, went underground politically between the Scopes trial and the 1950s, really. And so they weren't speaking for themselves. And also the fact that Brian did make a lot of mistakes in his testimony at that trial. He really wasn't ready for it. He hadn't thought through a lot of the issues, and it was easy to make fun of him. Meant that when he died right afterwards, that's the last thing people remember. But people forget that he wouldn't have been there in the first place if he hadn't been this enormously popular figure. He was asked to join the prosecution in the Scopes trial, and as soon as he was, Clarence Darrow immediately wanted to join the other side because he knew that this would become a huge, you know, media event, the so-called trial of the century, because these two figures were such powerful and in many ways popular figures at the time. So I think, yes, it has obviously besmirched his memory, and most people who reviewed the book have said, well, you know, this is Brian, you know, besides the Scopes trial. But I think it's also important to realize that he did not, he saw every cause he took part in as a great social reform, including this one, as wrong as he was about it.
Hmm. Well, just as a way of finishing up here in the 2-3 minutes that we have left, maybe we could again talk a little bit about the way that Brian put his stamp, in a sense, on the Democratic Party, and that contributed to, one probably would not say something like without Brian there would have been no New Deal, but that certainly a lot of the kind of policies that we associate with the New Deal, and also perhaps that also started would have started with Woodrow Wilson,
mm-hmm.
Certainly reflect Brian's priorities and hit the fact that he was a leader in the Democratic Party, had a lot of support in the party, had a lot to do with the fact that then the party moved in that direction, which is really different. That's a very different Democratic Party than the one that had come before.
Yes, before him, the Democratic Party was a conservative party, you know, economically and socially in American life. It was the laissez-faire party, the classically liberal party, if you will, that wanted the government to keep its hands off of everything. And he was the key figure, I think, in shifting that to talk about what you might call a positive liberalism, where the government does take responsibility for social problems, and also where the government is a countervailing force to big business. And big business was the was more powerful than the federal government during his lifetime. And one could argue it still is, but he really thought the government should be on the side of ordinary people, and that means that, that its money should be used to help ordinary people as opposed to subsidizing business. And so in that sense, Democrats, most of them, you know, still are Bryanites.
Do you think he would have made a good president?
Probably not. Probably not. He wasn't a very good Secretary of State, and he wasn't a good administrator. He was a great campaigner. He was a great crusader. He was a great preacher, a lay preacher, but he would have been, I think, perplexed at having to compromise all the time. That was not his strength.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving some of your time. He was a fascinating figure, and it's a very interesting book, and I certainly would recommend it to folks.
Well, thank you very much.
Our guest, Michael Kazin, he's professor of history at Georgetown University, has written several books about American history, and he's the author of this book that we've been talking about here this morning. It is a newly published biography of William Jennings Bryan. The title of the book is A Godly Hero, and it is published by Knopf. And you have been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, first broadcast on June 28th. Many past interviews from Focus are available on our website. Also, from the Afternoon Magazine, a lot of our other local programming is there. It's at will.uiuc.edu, so you should go there and check it out and see what's available. Tomorrow morning on our program, we will have new live shows. In the first hour, we'll visit with Jim Kaler. He is Emeritus Professor of Astronomy at the University of Illinois. And it's been a while since he's been with us, but every once in a while we asked him to come into the program and talk a little bit about what you can see in the sky at particular times of the year. And of course, that changes all through the year. We'll talk about the late summer sky and what's available in the first hour tomorrow. Then hour two, we will talk with another biographer. This is Debbie Applegate, and we will be talking about a recent biography that she has done of Henry Ward Beecher. Now, I think a lot of people will recognize the name of Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. That was his sister. She is probably one of the most best-known Beechers now, but in his time, he was one of the best-known speakers in the United States, was known as in being involved in a number of progressive causes, was a strong opponent of slavery, believed in the women's right to vote, and his sermons were extremely popular. People flocked to hear him speak. Abraham Lincoln said he thought that Beecher was one of the most influential men in America. So tomorrow we'll find out more about his life as we talk with Debbie Applegate about her new book, The Most Famous Man in America, the biography of Henry Ward Beecher. That's tomorrow. Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Body Work Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Body Work has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. We'll now make way for the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we will have an interview from the archives. We will go back to an interview from April when we talked with Al Jeaney, a professor of philosophy at Loyola University. We talked with him about The Sopranos. He says that show is not unlike a traditional morality play, and Tony Soprano, a New Jersey crime boss, is a compelling anti-hero. That's what we've got in store for this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. Kansas, September wheat, 482 and three quarters, up three quarters. To Chicago now, and September wheat, 398, up five and a half. December, 418, up four and three quarters. September corn, 246 and a half, up six. December, 263 and a quarter, up five and a half. March, 277 and a quarter, up six.